This is for you. This is for you. My name is Bill. I'm a barefoot alcoholic. You probably want to sit down for this. She doesn't know what I'm about to say, and I can't believe I'm going to say it. It's funny, Mike and I were talking before the meeting started because I couldn't remember when I first met Carrie and Adam. And I guess it was about 4.5 years ago. And soon after that, pretty immediately we had some conversations, and pretty immediately it was obvious that we had similar passions. And recently someone referred to someone else as a serious spiritual seeker. And I would refer to Carrie as a serious spiritual seeker. And one of the first things that I had seen her do was a presentation, and it was sort of a back to basics with a lot of Oxford Group stuff involved, if I remember correctly. And we were in a really silly mood that weekend. And what we did was we started noticing that each time she would describe an aspect of the book in a very knowledgeable and experiential way, that very often she would use sexual connotation unknowingly. And we sat there and we kept track of all the different innuendo that she had kept track of, and it got distracting for her because she saw that we were doing something. We were laughing because she absolutely wasn't meaning to do that, and I'm wondering if she's going to do it tonight now since I brought it up. But notice it if she does it because it's very funny. No, I'm just kidding. And I was very impressed with this woman that I got to know and that I've seen over the years, because most definitely there's been some incredible growth from the 5 years that I've known her, and to the point where a lot of you know that we do big book studies and stuff like that, a woman had come to me from Allentown, Pennsylvania, and said to me, you know, Bill, would you do a big book study for us? And I said, yeah, definitely. And they said, well, but the only condition is that you need to do it with a woman, because we want to get a male perspective and a female perspective. And without batting an eye, I said to this woman, I definitely would love to do a big book study with a female, but there's only one that I would be willing to do it with, and that was Carrie. And if she's available that weekend, I definitely am available. And if she's not available, then I'd rather just say no. And she was available that weekend, and we did a study, and it was really phenomenal, and it helped a lot of people. And I personally do not know very many women that do as much work for AA as Carrie does. There's an amazing amount of women that Carrie works with. There's an amazing amount of personal transformation and reworking the steps and carrying that message to other women. And with that, I'd like to introduce Carrie C.
Sorry about that. I didn't know when I was supposed to get up or not. and everything Bill said was lies, not kidding. I really want to thank you for asking me here. You know, it's an honor to be invited to speak at a group. I mean, it's always an honor. It's an honor to be invited to speak in an AA meeting, but it's an immense honor to be asked to speak at this meeting for many reasons. First of all, because when I first really started to get serious about working the 12 steps, I found people in this group who helped me, because you guys have been a beacon of light in Alcoholics Anonymous for a very long time, and because there's so many women that I know today who are really involved in this group and have gotten so much from it. So not only have you given to me, but you've given to people that I love. And for that, I am so honored and so grateful to be here with you tonight. And I'm just amazed that, you know, you guys have been doing this for this long. And more than that, there are some people in this room tonight who, like Bill and Mike and so many other people, who have really helped me so much on my path and have helped me to grow immensely. And they've touched my lives. And because of my life, they've touched my life. And because of that, I am so honored to be here tonight. 45 minutes? I think I could do that. I'm kidding. You know, the one message, the one thing that I want to get across to everybody tonight, and the one thing that I want to do when I speak, or my main thought, my thesis for the night, I want it to be that the power of God is real and the power of God works. You know, I could beat the big book, but I think I'm preaching to the choir here. But what I really want to talk about, what I want to talk about is what happened to me, how a girl who came into Alcoholics Anonymous when she was 16 and got sober at 18, who wanted to die, who committed attempted suicide, I don't know how many times, like, but if you have to start counting, you know it's bad. I was completely, completely non-functional. I could not live in the world. I could not have relationships. I couldn't be in the same room with my mother. I couldn't have relationships with my family. I couldn't have a boyfriend because, like, I just couldn't. I would drive them away. I could not have close relationships. The only relationship I had in my life was with booze. And I went from that, it'll be 10 years next week, God willing, to this. And the question is how did I get to that point? You know, how did I come from being a hopeless alcoholic to being a recovered alcoholic? And the answer is very simple. The power of God and the 12 steps. Not all that easy to do, but a very simple answer. My journey through the steps has been an interesting, windy one. I don't know a lot of people who like it, like, you know, who go straight out the gate and, you know, I mean, I think it's wonderful the people who, like, walk out of detox and find a big book thumper and bring them through the steps and they do it right away and have this great experience. It's not exactly what happened to me. I did some time in AA. I call it 90 dances in 90 days. I first hit the rooms when I was 16. I hit the rooms when I was 16 because I was drinking uncontrollably. I first started drinking. The first drink I can possibly remember, I think I was 9. My parents gave me wine when I was younger. I drank. I lived 2 lives. I was the good little girl on one side, and I was the bad hellraiser on the other. I never the twain shall meet. And I lived 2 very different lives for a really long time until, like, I couldn't pretend to be the good little girl anymore, and I was just the alcoholic mess. What's really funny is, like, there are people in this room who have known me since I was, like, 15 years old, and so it's kind of weird telling this story because it's like, you know, there are people, like, and people have known me since I got sober. I mean, this is an amazing night. So basically what happens to me when I drink alcohol, I have this thing called craving. What that means is that once I put alcohol in my system, I can't stop drinking. And I find that once I take one drink, I want another. And if I don't drink, I become irritable, restless, and discontent, and I get filled with anxiety, my heart pounds out of my chest, and all I want to do is drink, goddammit, and you're in my way. That's what happens to me when I drink. I have this mind that says, but that's okay. Everybody else drinks like that. It'll work this time. It'll be okay. You won't end up back in the psych ward. 4-point restraints aren't that bad. You know, you won't get caught. You can hide it. I've never been a very subtle person. You know, so there is no subtlety to my drinking either. And I have this spiritual malady that kicks my butt and has kicked my butt more than once in the past 10 years. And what it does is this, is that I have an extreme insecurity complex. I mean, I am such an insecure mess at times, and I was when I got sober. I didn't know where I ended and you began. What you thought about me became my truth. Like, if you thought I was a bad person, then I was a bad person. If you thought I was great, I was great. Because the problem is that I couldn't behave well. I had a real trouble with working well and playing nice with others. So I was in this constant state of self-hatred because I had no sense of self, no idea who I was, and I kept stepping on the toes of fellows, and they would retaliate, seemingly without provocation. So what would happen to me was simply that I would bring my little tornado, my whirlwind of alcoholic insanity into people's lives, and they'd kick me out like they should. And the more that happened, the lower and smaller I felt. See, the thing is, I didn't want to be messed up. I didn't want to be a crazy alcoholic. My nickname in high school was Crazy Carrie. I had 2 nicknames. It was Crazy Carrie and Janis Joplin. They used to call me, "Hey, Janice," because I had this big mop of hair that came down to here. You couldn't see my face. Looked kind of like Cousin It. or Crazy Carrie, you know, because I was known for lighting fires. I was known for, like, if you pissed me off in class, I would go over a desk and smash your face into it, like, a lot of times. I was known for not being able to control my behavior. Let's just put that. And almost all those things were done under the influence of alcohol. So basically, I would bring that into people's lives, and they'd kick me out. And then I would sit there and think, what's wrong with me? Why can't I just be normal? Why can't I be like everybody else? Why can't I just not say these things or do these things? Or why do I have to set fires? And I never really understood. I didn't understand that I had this illness. I didn't understand that I was as powerless over my spiritual condition as I was over my drinking. I didn't understand that. All I knew was that I felt alone, degraded, filled with self-hatred, and the one solution that I had in my life, which was alcohol, didn't work for me anymore. You know, so I wandered into Alcoholics Anonymous after, like, I don't know, the umpteenth suicide attempt. Some of them weren't all that serious. Some of them were. I got thrown out of my house, and I got sent to live with my sister for a year. And, see, I was literally physically separated from alcohol because she lived in the woods and I didn't drive. Yeah. Oh. It was not a happy year for Miss Carrie. So Miss Carrie spent most of her time in her room hiding. And when I wasn't in my room hiding, I was out drinking. And I didn't really tell anybody this. My sister kind of kept it under wraps because she didn't want to get me in trouble because she felt that I had all this trouble because, you know, I got thrown out of my parents' house. I was dating drug dealers. I was doing all these bad things that I shouldn't do. And she didn't want me to get in any more trouble, so she didn't tell my parents. So I got sent home from Pennsylvania, a mess. And my parents really didn't know. I'd managed to get good grades that year in school because, you know, I was locked in the woods, you know. You, when you're in the woods with no car and it's like a three-hour walk to the liquor store, there's nothing to do. Except you walk to the liquor store, which I did do. But beyond that, I ended up getting good grades and getting accepted to this pretty decent private school. So my parents were under the impression that because I got good grades and I only threatened to kill a teacher once that year, and I did, that I was doing okay. So I came home, and I tried to be okay. I tried so hard. I wanted to be the little, good little Catholic school girl in my little kilt. I wanted to behave. I wanted so bad not to be that person. I thought that I could just leave that Carrie behind, that I could just leave her in Pennsylvania. Nobody had to know about how bad I was. Well, what happened was I met a nice guy, liked him a real lot, so I dumped him, ate a bottle of pills, woke up 3 days later in the intensive care unit of St. Joseph's Hospital, and it was another trip to the psych ward for Carrie. You know, and the main reason why I did that was because I started drinking again. See, I started drinking when I came home, and I wasn't really telling anybody. And I knew. And I got suspended from school, too, in the middle of this. Like, my third week of school, I got suspended again because I was drinking in school. And so basically what happened with me was that the delusion that Carrie was going to be normal, that if I could just leave that alcoholic, that bad Carrie, that sick Carrie in another state, and I could just pretend to be this somebody else, that I would be okay. But I wasn't. And I found somebody to drink with, and I drank, and it started all over again. But see, I couldn't face that anymore. I couldn't face failing one more time. So I did what any good alcoholic would do. I attempted suicide. And I ended up in Fair Oaks and another psych ward, and it was not bad as psych wards go. But what I did do is I ended up going to Alcoholics Anonymous. I started to go to meetings. And I began to identify that my problem was drinking and not, like, my family, not my brother, not my sister, not because nobody loved me, not because I had all these bad things happen to me, and I did. I have to say that I had a very interesting childhood. But the one thing that I learned about alcoholism is it's not causal. See, I'm not an alcoholic because, you know, alcoholism and drug addiction runs in my family. I'm not an alcoholic because I experienced physical abuse as a child. I'm not an alcoholic because I experienced sexual abuse as a child. And I'm not an alcoholic because I was date raped as a teenager. None of those things have anything to do with my alcoholism. I might be crazy because of those things, but I'm not an alcoholic because of those things. And, you know, all of those things happened to me, and I had to learn how to deal with them in sobriety. So, anyway, so I ended up going to some meetings, and it was interesting. I started attending NA before I started attending AA, because I thought that was, like, more fun because there was more younger people there. But what happened was, you know, they make this announcement at the very beginning of NA meetings. They said, you know, if you have any drugs or alcohol on, drugs on you, you know, you need to leave them out the door. You know, you can't bring them into the church. So every time they made that announcement, I'd wait about 3 or 4 minutes and go smoke a cigarette and kick around in the bushes going, did anybody leave anything? So needless to say, I wasn't all that serious, but I began to go. And I began to see that there were young people there. There were young people in AA. There were young people in these programs, and they were getting better. But see, I didn't want to get better. I just wanted the pain to stop. So naturally, I couldn't stay. And what happened is I ended up picking up again. I ran away from home. I was gone for a while. I put my mother and my father through hell. And towards the end of my 17th year, no, my 16th year, I'm sorry, my mom had me arrested in her living room. Yeah, I heard the Al-Anon saying, good job. I came home after being run away. After running away, I came home, and it was a Monday morning, it was 9 o'clock, and I really thought my parents weren't going to be there. So it's hot up here. I'm, like, so sweaty. My hair's sticking to me. I'm, like, sweating to death, if you excuse me. But I really thought my mother wasn't going to be there. So I went to go break in because, you know, naturally I didn't have a key. I went to break into my parents' house to steal from them. But my mother was home. So she said, okay, you can come in, but you have to go to rehab. You have to go. And I said, okay, I can stay on the streets and continue drinking, or I can get locked up again. See ya. And I left, and I waited till what I thought was her car pull away. And I tried to break in again, like an idiot. And she was still there. It wasn't her car. So she called the cops, and I ended up fighting about, I don't know, 4 to 6 Bloomfield police officers in my parents' living room. And they arrested me. They brought me to the police station, and I got a police escort to my last rehab. And they sat with me through the whole intake. They brought me up to the ward. They were making sure that I was in there. But you'd think that would scare an alcoholic sober. Your mother has you arrested. You have to beat up. You know, you're fighting. I got my butt kicked. You know, I got my butt kicked by 6 police officers. I was like 90 pounds. You know, there is no way that I was like winning that fight. You know, and you would think that getting your butt kicked in your parents' living room by a bunch of police officers would make you stop drinking, right? No. So I went to rehab, and I took all the slogans, you know, like, easy does it, you know, first things first, think, upside down, all that crap. And I lived that, you know, I lived a slogan recovery. And I got out, and I got a coffee commitment. I made meetings every day. I got a boyfriend. That was important. I did everything I thought I was supposed to do. You know, I took it easy does this, but do it. You know, so I didn't get a job. lived off my parents. First things first, I went to meetings every day. And I did these things, and I thought one day at a time, I didn't drink today, this is good. I'm doing a good job. Well, a year later, I picked up a drink. A little over a year later, I picked up a drink. And I picked up a drink because I didn't have a sufficient solution. I'm a sufficient substitute, excuse me. I didn't have a sufficient substitute for alcohol in my life. See, I had taken the alcohol away, but I hadn't filled it up with anything but fluff, but frothy emotional appeal. And because of that, there came a point in time in my life where it was more painful to be sober than it was to be drunk. And the consequences that I got from drinking paled in comparison to the excruciating emotional pain of reality. Have you ever been there? Oh, it sucks, doesn't it? So, you know, knowing all that I knew, all the self-knowledge, all the, you know, just don't drink today. I went to a meeting, and I walked in the meeting, and I said, well, if the speaker sucks, I'm leaving, and I'm going to get drunk. And naturally, the speaker sucked. And I left, and I got drunk. In the meantime, oh, by the way, I was already on my second boyfriend. I didn't forget. I was already on my second boyfriend, who was clean like 3 days when I met him. Because, you know, like, you know, that whole 13-stepping thing is really healthy for your spiritual life. So I was working on my second boyfriend, and, you know, he had a couple days clean. I had a little over a year, but I was miserable. And we decided we were going to go get drunk. And it was like, if this meeting sucks, we're going to go drink. And naturally, it sucked, so we went and got drunk. And I said to myself, this is what I said, and this is why I'm a real alcoholic. I said, okay, I'm going to drink tonight. And I'm just going to have this drink, and I'm going to get drunk because I'm 18 and I deserve it, because I should party like a kid because I'm a kid and I deserve this. And I'm going to get drunk, but I'm going to go back to AA tomorrow. What's time mean? What's clean time? It means nothing. I'm sober only as long, you know, as, you know, basically the idea that it, like, the person who wakes up earliest in the morning is sober the longest. So what if I drink? I'll wake up early the next day, and I'll go to AA, and everything will be okay. So after not having had any alcohol in my system for a year and a half, I proceeded to drink massive quantities of alcohol, like massive quantities. We're talking like anything to get my hands on, tequila, I mean, like everything I hadn't done, and the new stuff that came out while I was sober, like Zima, all this stuff. I drank and drank. I drank like my whole paycheck in one night. And I woke up the next day, and I'm standing too close to the mic. I woke up the next day, and I had about $5 in change on me. Because one night of drinking costs a lot of money, man. I had $5 left on me, and I said, well, I can either buy cigarettes or I can buy alcohol. Now, this is a tough decision. So I dug around on the couch cushions for a little bit, found a little bit more change, and I went to the liquor store, and I bought cheap wine and a pack of cheap cigarettes, and I drank for the next 4 months. And see, for me, no matter how long I'm away from alcohol, no matter how long I'm away, once I put it into my system, I have no choice of when I stop. See, the thing with me is I don't get done with alcohol. Alcohol gets done with me. I have no choice as to when I stop drinking once I put alcohol in my system. The only thing that comes between me and the bottle is a power greater than myself. And one day, about 4 months later, the day after my now husband's birthday, I woke up and crawled out of a basement because I had lost my apartment. I had lost the two jobs I had. I was about to lose the boyfriend. And everything that I had built up in that year and a half, I lost everything. And I was homeless, living on the streets. And my clothes were in a garbage bag. And I had been out the night before, and we partied our paycheck away again because we were going to get an apartment. We swore we were going to get an apartment this time. But, you know, I had a drink. And I woke up, and I crawled out of this basement, and I'm like, I can't do this anymore. I don't know why that came to me. I don't know. All I know is that that moment, the power of God came into my life. And I walked, and it took me about an hour, and I walked to an AA meeting. And I went and sat in that meeting, and I cried. I stole their big book, which I then replaced. I have now made amends and replaced. And I went to another meeting after that, and then I went to another meeting later that night. And I went to a meeting the next day, and I just kept going to meetings. But see, the problem was is at that point, I was scared enough of drinking, but I still didn't have anything to replace the alcohol with. So I was a very miserable person. And I lived unhappily like that for 2 years. And I wandered. God saw fit to move my husband and I and my daughter, because I ended up getting pregnant. I found out I was pregnant 60 days sober, so I ended up getting pregnant. I think it was during detox. I got pregnant during my detox. I found out I was pregnant with my daughter when I was 60 days sober. And I knew that I couldn't drink because I had someone else to be sober for the first time in my life. But see, I didn't know how not to drink, and I didn't know how to live. And I was very miserable. And I had my daughter when I was a little over 10 months clean. And my husband got a job opportunity in Staten Island. And I moved to Staten Island. And see, there's this awesome community in Staten Island, this big book community who, you know, worked the steps out of the book. And I kept hearing these people talking about, like, working the steps out of the book. And I had worked the steps out of the step book. And well, actually, I worked some of the steps out of the step book. Some of it I took it out of the big book, and I did a three-column, four-step because that was the picture. I still, like, the only thing I would change about the big book is have Bill illustrate the fourth column because there's a lot of lazy alcoholics like myself. So he only put three on here. So that was the amount of work that I had done up until that point. And I had this eight-step list, and I had made some really half-ass amends, just enough to alleviate the pain. And I hadn't done a four-step, so I couldn't really own my part. So I made amends so that everybody would like me. It didn't really, you know, sink in, like, exactly what I did or why they didn't like me to begin with. So I ended up moving to Staten Island, and my husband met these people who were working the steps out of the big book. And a little bit at a time, I met all these people who were doing this. And there was this awesome community of people who were doing this thing. And I started to go through the steps. I got caught up in the enthusiasm of it. And that's what I love about these meetings. I love people who are enthusiastic about the steps. Because if you're boring about the steps, why would I want to do them? If the steps don't illuminate your life, if they don't change you on a radical level, in the deepest fibers of yourself, then why would I want to do them? But I saw these people who had this immense change, who did this awesome stuff, who worked with all these people and had all these groups and did all this stuff. And I was like, I want to do that. I want that. You know? So I began to work the steps. And I got up to my third step. I was working with a man, and I felt uncomfortable continuing to do a fourth and a fifth step with a guy. So I ended up, I found a set of Joe and Charlie tapes. And I got their little worksheets, and I filled them out. And my friend and I both, we were doing the steps together at the same time. So we both, my friend Denise, I shared my fifth step with her, and she shared her fifth step with me. And we swapped fifth steps. And we wrote up our nine-step amends, and our eight-step list, and we went out and made our amends. And something happened in my life. Something changed. I didn't want to die anymore. I didn't have the rage inside of me. You know that rage where you just can't control it? It's like I'll see myself throwing something before I know what I threw it. That doesn't happen to me anymore. And there was a time in my life where I was so uncontrollable. My emotions dictated every aspect of my life. If I felt it, I was saying it and doing it. You know, which was dangerous to those about me, trust me. I went through many remote controls because of that. I had a habit of throwing the remote control because it would seem like the least, like, harmful thing to throw. You know, I don't know. And it was handy, portable, fit in my hand, nice toss. But, so, you know, something began to happen in my life, and I stopped doing those things. Like, I stopped reacting to the world like that. And I began to work with newcomers. And then, you know, God brought me to New Jersey. And I was doing this in New Jersey. I found Back to Basics, and I was doing Back to Basics out of my living room. And there was a group of people who were all like-minded, and we were all doing this. And the amazing thing is I was actually at a sober club promoting a dance. And there were a bunch of girls there who knew this, the set-aside prayer. And it was something that I had learned in Staten Island from a guy who worked with Joe Hawk. And I'm like, you know that? You speak my language? You know what I'm talking about? Hold me. I'm like, oh my God, who the hell are you? Who's your sponsor? Where do you go? And I wound up wandering into Bernardsville. And I ended up getting a sponsor. And the first time I had been sponsored by a woman through the book. Up until that point, I had been kind of working it on my own and with other people and with sponsees. And we all kind of did it in a communal thing. But I had never been brought through the book from page one to the end. And I had this woman who did that for me, and it was the most amazing experience in my life. And that's how I said I had this windy path through the steps. And anybody who's sitting here who's in early sobriety and doing this work, I mean, God bless you. I mean, it took me years of pain in order to really, really find this solution. And it's been an amazing journey for me. I have, like I said, it's like the one thing I want to get across is the power of God is real and it works in my life. I have an amazing life. I do amazing things. I have a family that I look at my family, the family that I grew up in, and I still can't believe that they were the same people I hated for years. You know, we went through the steps and I made direct amends to my mother owning everything that I did. And for the first time in my life, I didn't make my amends wanting her to return it. demanding that she be the mother I wanted her to be. Because she failed me, don't you know? She's the one who messed me up, and that's why I have to be in this damn place. And that's the way I felt my whole life. It was like, she did something wrong, and that's why I'm stuck in AA. You know, because at that time, for a long time, I really believed that my alcoholism was caused by outside circumstances. I didn't know about craving. I didn't know about these things. I didn't know about my spiritual malady. No one, you know, and when I found out about it, it's like I couldn't blame the people in my life for doing what they did, because I am who I am because of who I am. You know, and I went and I made these amends, and I had such a sense of relief, such a sense of, it's indescribable to me. I can't tell you what happened inside of me. All I know is that I was a terrified little girl, you know, when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. I was a terrified little girl for a very long time, and something happened inside of me, and I became a woman. And I mean that I had strength and integrity that I never knew before. I had this confidence that I never knew existed. And I had the ability to love other people in a way that I had never done before. See, the most amazing thing about the 12 steps is it gives me the gift of love. For years, I was dominated by the belief that if only you behaved differently, I would be okay. And if only you loved me, then I would be okay. See, I never thought about what I was bringing to anything. I never thought about, what do I bring to this relationship? What do I offer this person? What can I do to be of service to you? It was always about, you make me feel good because I am nothing without you. And what the 12 steps have given me, what God has given me, is the ability to love people without the condition. Doesn't mean I do it perfectly. You can ask anybody around me, but I really do. I mean, I can have unconditional love for people in a way that I never knew before, and I can live without judgment. See, this is one of my biggest issues was that, I love issue man, one of my biggest issues was that I judged myself and everyone around me to such an extreme level. Like, I was basically, and this is what I learned through doing a lot of inventory, because I learned that I judged other people because I was afraid you were going to hurt me. And if I found out what it was about you that was threatening to me, I could push you away before I had to risk being hurt. So I lived my whole life keeping everybody at arm's length, evaluating everything about you. But see, what the problem was is that every time I judged you on something, I would look in the mirror now and again and be like, oh, I do that. And then my sense of self, my self-love would shrink. Because I'd judge you, I'd behave the same way as you and have to hate myself because of it. And I love it that in the big book, on page 42, it tells us that, you know, we can have philosophical convictions galore. It says that we can have all these moral beliefs. It tells us that we can believe anything that we want to believe about spiritual terms, but we have a hard time living up to it because we lack power. See, lack of power was my dilemma. I knew how I should behave. I knew how other people should behave. But the fact is that I lacked the power to institute that in my life. And what the 12 steps did, what God has done, is given me the power to live up to the ideals that I set forth to myself. And to be loving with myself when I fall short. To admit it when I fall short. And so, my judgment, and it kept me from being able to really love anybody, to let anybody in, to develop close relationships, to let go of the anger towards my family, to let go of the anger towards the people in my life. And what I learned, and when I realized that my judgment was killing me, I was doing absolutely nothing to you, but it was killing me. Because, see, love and judgment can't live together. They don't work together. And I can say I love you, but if I'm in my head going, but if only you, then see, I'm not loving you. I'm telling you who you should be. Then I'm playing God. And see, what I love about the third step is it tells us, it says that, first of all, we have to quit playing God. See, God is my director. I am the actor. He is the principal. I am the agent. He is the father. I am the child. And I cannot allow... God can't work through me when I'm fighting him. See, I can't serve God when I'm playing God. And I spent most of my recovery doing that. And when I learned that this is what I was doing, when I saw it and I felt the powerlessness of it, when I realized that I was as powerless over my fear, my resentment, and my selfishness as I was over my alcoholism, that I could not wish them away any more than I could wish away alcohol. I had to have a power greater than myself. I had to turn to God to fix me because I could not fix me. So for a long time, I believed that if I gave God my alcoholism, my drinking, that I would be okay. And that I would control my relationships. I would control my job. I'd control my children. I'd control all these things. And everything would be okay. You just keep me from drinking, God, and I'll handle everything else. And what I learned was that I can't live in communion with my higher power like that. That's not how God works in my life. So what happened is I hit bottoms in recovery. I'd hit a bottom with a certain relationship, a certain thing. And when I say relationship, I don't just mean people. I mean my relationship with myself, my relationship to God, my relationship with my husband, relationship with my children, my family, my sponsees, my friends, ad infinity. You know, the 12 steps are about relationships. And they're about my relationship with God, and as a result of my relationship with God, what happens with my relationship with people. It's very simple arithmetic. If my relationship with God, if I'm living in communion with my Creator, if I'm living in the sunlight of the Spirit, if I am in the realm of the Spirit, then my relationships with people are pretty good. They're full of love. They're full of compassion, empathy, companionship. See, but I'm not living in those things. My relationships are the complete opposite. And what I really love, and I love to do with my sponsees, and whenever I'm doing a big book workshop, I love to go to page 52. And I love to read the bedevilments, and then I like to turn it to the 9-step promises. And if you've ever noticed, the bedevilments on 52 are almost the exact opposite of the 9-step promises. And there's a reason for that, because somewhere between step 2 and step 9, something happens in your life. If you really do this, and if you live this, something happens in my life. Something happens in an alcoholic's life. What happens is God comes in and starts to rearrange you. And I love that. That's why the 3rd and the 7th step prayer is like, my Creator, build with me as thou will. Of course, I'm not saying taking little pieces of it, but what I'm saying is it's talking about my Creator, and ask God to build with me as thou will. So what am I saying? I'm saying, God, create me and use me in your creation. So I can be involved in the creation of this world on 2 very different levels, internal and external. I can serve God and be a part of life at last. And I can allow God to create me in his likeness and image, in the way that he wants me to be, good or bad. Take it all. I don't evaluate anymore. I don't have the capacity to evaluate my own self anymore. All I can do is surrender this self to God and ask God to do it for me. And when I live in that place, I'm a very happy person. I'm free. I have hope. I have joy. I can do things that I never thought I could do. I can be effective in ways that I cannot imagine. You know, what I love is when I'm doing my morning meditation, and, you know, I sit down, I have my pad and my pen, and I do the Oxford Group meditation. As Bill pointed out, I'm a little bit of an Oxford Group person, and I like Big Book AA, and I like Big Book AA without a lot of fluff. You know, just give me the big book, and I love it. I love it. I eat it up. I enjoy it. I suck the marrow out of the big book. I love it. That's a poem, by the way. I didn't make that up. Not kidding. But I devour the big book. And what I love is I sit there in morning meditation. I still have my little pad, my little pen that I had when I first started doing the work. And I make my list for the day. Like, you know, how am I to serve you today, God? And I sit quiet and I make my list. And all these things come to my head. And it's like, sometimes it's like, shut up. Sometimes it's be loving. Sometimes it's be patient. Call so-and-so. Call so-and-so. Do this, do that, do this, do that. And sometimes it doesn't make any sense. Like dogs barking, sun, you know. Sometimes it's just kooky. But when I hold it up to the 4 absolutes and I look at what my plan is for the day, sometimes it's call this sponsor, call this person. Or it could just be a name, and I'm going to see that person that day. And, you know, and I call my sponsee, and they're like, you know, I was about to call you. I want a drink. But I was too scared to call you. And see, and that's what I'm talking about, living in the sunlight of the Spirit. That's what I'm talking about, being in the realm of the Spirit. That's what I'm talking about being of service to God. See, when I allow God to direct my day, I can do the most amazing things. I can know things. That vital sixth sense that the Big Book talks about, Bill's not joking. He chose his words of the Big Book very, very carefully. And if you read that book, there's nothing that's in there by accident. And when he talks about that vital sixth sense, that's what he's talking about. It's about looking at somebody and seeing the mask, seeing them putting up the mask, hiding the fact that they're in pain and knowing it. Because I'm, for once, not thinking about myself. See, and if I could not think about myself for 5 minutes, I could be of immense service to the world. And see, when I can do that, when I can live in that, the effectiveness of God, the effectiveness of this program, and the reason why I'm here is apparent. So the point of the 12 steps is, and I love this, a speaker at my group said this. She said the point of the 12 steps is not to stop drinking. The result of the 12 steps is to have a spiritual experience, to have a spiritual awakening. The vital spiritual experience, psychic change, whatever you want to call it, that is the point of this. The book stops talking about drinking very early on. And the fact is that it tells us to lay aside the drink problem and look at the causes and conditions in our life. It tells us to look at why we're having a rough going. So the point for me is that I work at the 12 steps, and I live this not because I don't want to drink. I started because I didn't want to drink. And I certainly don't want to drink, and I certainly don't want to die. But the result has been an amazing spiritual awakening and an amazing turnaround in my life. And these things that have happened to me, not because of anything that I did myself. And see, this is the thing, is that on my own, I'm a catatonic, suicidal, alcoholic. Very good description of me. That's me on my own. With God in my life, I can be so much more. I can be an effective mother. I can be an effective sponsor. I can be an effective wife. I can be an effective friend. I can be effective in areas in my life that I could never do before. And, you know, I'm blessed today. I have a lot of sponsees. And it's amazing to me that these women actually want me to work with them. I'm always like, are you sure? You know, you know you're talking to me, right? You know I'm crazy, right? You're sure about this? And they all just kind of laugh. They're like, yeah, we know you're crazy, but we love you. And, you know, bring me through the steps. And I have to tell you that, see, I didn't realize, when I keep talking about this vital spiritual experience, when I talk about vital as in, like, life, vital, when I talk about this, I didn't realize that it had happened to me until I began to work with other alcoholics. See, when I was sitting across my kitchen table and I was listening to one of my sponsees tell me this harrowing, harrowing story, and I was able to find clarity. Like, I was able to feel her pain, yet I was able to bring her through it. And I was able to bring her through to their fourth column. And I didn't get mired in, what a jerk. I had love and compassion, yet I was able to bring her through that. And the fact that the woman trusted me enough to tell me these things, and I was able to have the presence of mind, I was able to be present in that moment to help get her to God in that situation. See, that has nothing to do with me. It has to do with the power of God that dwells within each one of us. And I believe this, and, you know, like I said, the opinions of the speaker, I really believe that there's a little bit of God in each one of us. And that deep down inside every man, woman, and child is a fundamental idea of God. That we might have to search fearlessly, but it's there. And my job as an alcoholic today, my job as a recovered alcoholic, is to continue to seek that little speck of God within me, that idea of God. And to, you know, I explained to my sponsees, and I said, you know, a relationship with God is a relationship with anyone else. If you don't talk to them, you can't have a relationship. And if you don't listen, the relationship isn't working. So for me, I have to use my relationship with God in order to be more effective. You know, I can't just call up God and say, hi, this is my second step. I believe you're there, and I'll get back to you in 10. It doesn't work that way with me. You know, how am I going to trust a God that I have no experience with? And so my job is to continue to deepen and broaden my experience with God so that my trust, my reliance on this power can become deeper and greater. So then it was not just giving him my alcoholism or giving him my little teeny bits of unmanageability here and my teeny bits of unmanageability there, but I'll take care of all the rest. So I can get to a point in my life where I can surrender myself to God. Now, mind you, I'm a human being, and it sounds really good, and I do live like this. But there are days when I don't, and I make amends for that too. And I make that really clear up here that I have clay feet, that I'm a human being, and I fall short. That's why I send my sponsees all the time. I said, that's why we have step 10. I said, continue to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admit it. So, and Bill later on says that, that we may make assumptions based on what we think to be God's will, but it may be completely wrong, and that's okay. Because I'm new at this game. I'm a newcomer. And slowly but surely, I'm gaining an experience with God. And because of that, I'm beginning to rely more and more on this power greater than myself. And the results I get are amazing. And I'm an alcoholic. I drank for effect. And I'm a recovered alcoholic, and I work the steps for an effect. And the effect that I get, is that I am not the Carrie that I was 10 years ago. And 10 years ago, I didn't want to be that Carrie. I hated that Carrie. I wanted to be anyone else but myself. And today, and this is the amazing thing, is that I used to look at, all the speakers, I used to look at guys like Howard, guys like Bill and Mike, guys like Mark Houston and Joe Hawk and all these guys, and I'd be like, I want what they have, so I got to do what they do. And that worked. And now today, I want what I have. I want to be me and have my experience. Because for the first time in my life, I'm okay with that. See, because the one thing that I learned was that I was either up here or down here. I was always a piece of crap or the best thing that there ever was. But that I was never in reality. And what I learned humility was knowing exactly who I am, good and bad. It's not about saying false humility, claiming to suck when I don't. And it's not about grandiosity that I'm great at everything. What humility is knowing who I am and loving it anyway. And today I've been able to do that. I've been able to truly look myself in the mirror, know my faults, and love me anyway. I have my bad days, but they are far and few between compared to where I was. And so to recap and just let you know, now I've been talking about this amazing life that I have, right? Well, I've been married. I've been married for, we'll be together like 10 years. We have two children. So I'm 28 years old. I'll be sober 10 years next week, knock wood, by the grace of God. I have two children. I'm in college. I sponsor vast quantities of women. I have not had a harsh word to my mother in over 3 years. I've not yelled at that woman. And trust me, that's good. I have a relationship with every single member of my family. There is not one brother or sister that I sit there and they're like, yeah. You know how you have that brother and sister thing, like, yeah, they're, I love them, but they're really a schmuck. I don't have that with any of my family. And the reason why I don't is because the beautiful thing called the nine step. I was able to go back to the people in my family that I hurt, and the people that hurt me. I was able to find forgiveness in my heart. I was able to go with a frank and loving and forgiving attitude. And I went and I admitted my harms. And because I've done that, no matter where they are in their life, I've been able to find freedom. And so I have this wonderful relationship with this family that I hated. I have the amount of friends that I have in my life, sometimes I lose count of them. I forget who I'm talking to sometimes because I have a wonderful home group. I have a family in AA. I have my AA family. I have my blood family. And what the amazing thing is, my blood family, my AA family know each other. That's pretty cool. I mean, think about that. I mean, for a long time, it was my AA family was over here and my blood family was over there, and those two were not going to meet because then someone would find out something about me. They'd start sharing notes and start comparing, and I'd get in trouble. See, but I don't live that double life anymore. So now, my blood family and my AA family, they've met, they know each other. They're a part of my life. And the thing that my sponsees tell me, and one of the main reasons why they hire me as a sponsor, is because when we first meet, almost every one of them, I said, well, listen, you know, you may want to work with me. I sound really good in a meeting, but you need to meet me. You need to come to my house. You need to see me in my element, and then you can decide whether you want to work with me. And so they come over, and they have a cup of coffee in my kitchen, and we talk about where they're at. I talk about where I'm at, and we just get to know one another. And as they're doing this, my children are usually throwing popcorn on the floor, fighting. Who's touching who? Who's hitting who with a golf club? Who's got who's what? And the phone's ringing off the hook with the million, you know, with the other ton of sponsees who are calling and have issues. And what happens is these women see that in my life, through the grace of God, by the power of God working in my life, that I can carry on a conversation with them, bandage a knee, answer the phone, and not lose it. And not lose it. And so for me, the best advertisement I have for the 12 steps is my life. And there's nothing greater than that. Because for me, the girl that I was could not do that. The girl that I was couldn't even look you in the eye. The girl that I was sat in AA meetings and couldn't get a cup of coffee for fear of getting up. And that's not the girl that I am today. And the girl that I am today can have an effect on other people's lives in an amazing way. And these women, moreover, can have an effect in my life. I can be as open and loving with my sponsees as they are with me. And I don't have to hide anything from them. I don't have to be, oh, I have to be the perfect sponsor and I can't fall short and I can't let you see my faults. My sponsees know who I am and they know my faults and they love me for it. And I do the same for them. And so for me, that's the fellowship of the Spirit. That's why I'm here. That's why I keep working the 12 steps, why I take on new sponsees, why I take on commitments, why I show up at meetings, why I do the damn GSR commitment and I chair the meeting and I do all these things. I do that because it's my job to give love to the world. And then when I do that, love is reflected back to me. And so what the 12 steps has given me is an ability to love without demanding to be loved, because I'm loved anyway. See, because if you guys don't love me, there's a power greater than myself that does, because I would not be standing here today if it didn't. And that's just my experience. I really want to thank you guys for having me here. Thank you for letting me share.